glucocorticoids because I've spent the last 30 years studying them. Human version, hydrocortisone, we are going to hear tons more about these. Other players that get secreted, increased secretory rates during stress, prolactin, glucagon, beta endorphin, we will get back to these. Meanwhile, in the next county, there are the hormones whose secretion is inhibited during stress. The parasympathetic nervous system, hormones like growth hormone, insulin, the reproductive hormones, we will see how all of these pieces fit together. Couple of final qualifiers here. Everything that I described here as the classic stress response is built around bringing about the classic cliched soundbite about what the stress response is about. Something mentioned earlier, it is turning on the flight or fright or fight response, the fight or flight. Whatever the number of Fs are in there, this was the classical picture, first pulled together by Walter Cannon, one of the godfathers of stress physiology back in the 20s. The stress response is about emergency arousal, fighting, fleeing. But it turns out that's not what always happening. And a few years ago, a scientist named Shelley Taylor began to point out that this may be an artifact by scientists spending way too much time studying this weird subset of subjects, males. The stress response in males is predominantly about fight or flight. In females, it can be in lots of species doing affiliative behaviors, running and making sure your kids are okay, that sort of thing mediated by completely different hormones. And just showing she means business, Taylor came up with a soundbite of her own. Often, what the stress response is about is tend and befriend. So we've just made the picture a little bit more complicated. Some of it is about fight or flight, some of it tend and befriend, but nonetheless, we've now gotten the major players. Increased secretion of epinephrine, glucocorticoids, glucagon, prolactin, those guys. Decreased activation of the parasympathetic nervous system, growth hormone. Again, we are going to hear more about all of these. Couple of final qualifiers as well. What I'm implying here is with any sort of stressor, physical or psychosocial, you turn on the exact same stress response. I've been emphasizing this since the first lecture. In other words, you secrete epinephrine and glucocorticoids. You don't secrete the exact same amount for every type of stressor. And a very trendy thing in the field now is looking at stress signatures. Particular stressors have different epinephrine to glucocorticoid ratios. Minutia. For our purposes, each stressor turns on roughly the same stress response. Final detail, and one that seems like sheer obscurity, which is, oh yeah, not everybody has the exact same stress response. There's individual differences. As we will see, individual differences is what the rest of this course is about coping, is about learning to do things differently. The fact that all individuals differ in how their bodies respond to stress is great, because once we figure out the folks who are doing it just right, then we've got a model to go after. So that now sets us up for our first transition in the course, now that we've got the major players of the stress response in hand, to begin to look at how it plays out in a particular physiological system, the cardiovascular system. What is the acute stress response that's good news? What is the chronic stress response about, which is terrible news?
Lecture 3, Stress and Your Heart.
Well, we are now ready to start with our first organ system, looking at the cardiovascular system, and we now have two lectures worth of preparation under our belts. First lecture giving us what this organizing theme for this entire series being this dichotomy. If you are turning on the stress response because you're getting stressed like a normal mammal, you are doing something acute, energetic, explosive that's not going to last for too long. The stress response is wonderful. Saves your life, highly adaptive. On the other hand, a central theme of this entire course is if you turn on the stress response too long, too often for purely psychological reasons, that's when you set yourself up for getting sick. So that was the main theme coming out of lecture one. Lecture two provided us with the tools, the toolbox of how you go about activating the stress response, which hormones you begin to secrete more of, epinephrine, glucocorticoid, some other ones, which hormones you secrete less of, growth hormone, those reproductive sex hormones, and collectively, this is what powers your body to do that wonderfully adaptive stuff in the face of an acute stressor and all of that unhealthy disease-causing stuff in the face of chronic stress. So with that set here, now we can begin to apply those exact principles to the cardiovascular system. And in a lot of ways, if you wanted to pick the definitive, the iconic outpost of your body that gets done in by chronic stress, this is the one. Right off the bat, we know exactly how to apply the short-term logic. You are walking home from work, you're not quite paying attention, you come around a corner and, oh no, there's a lion there, and you have to go running for your life, and you better hope you turn on the cardiovascular stress response at that point. And it's actually very simple to do. If you don't worry about much in the way of details, you need to secrete glucocorticoids and epinephrine. You need to turn on the sympathetic nervous system, back one lecture, that SNS. And as we know from the previous lecture, if you were going to turn on the sympathetic, you were going to turn off the parasympathetic. So you've now got lots of epinephrine, lots of glucocorticoids in your bloodstream. Epinephrine directly increases cardiovascular activity. Glucocorticoids are interesting. They make it possible for epinephrine to work even more effectively. Really fancy biochemistry there. What they also do is they get up into your brain in very primitive brain stemmy areas and send messages to the neurons there, the neurons that send messages down to your heart. And suddenly everything kicks into gear, everything is more activated, your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure goes up, blood pressure secondarily from the heart rate going, you are pumping the blood out more frequently, it comes bashing back with more force, pumped out again. The entire process is very adaptive because now you're delivering more blood, more glucose, more oxygen all over your body. But you don't want to deliver it all over your body. This is a crisis, and you're not saving your life by increasing blood flow to your ears. You're saving your life by sending it where it's needed. Thigh muscles, for example, which are going to save your life. Your lungs, which have to be breathing fast enough to supply the oxygen. The parts of the brain being stimulated by those glucocorticoids. The part of the brain that powers your heart, your lungs, all of that. Those are the ones that need more blood. Meanwhile, there's parts of your body that don't need the excess blood, where you decrease the blood flow, you divert it away from there, you divert it from your gut, from your reproductive organs, all of that, and this makes wonderful sense. And this was actually something that was first noted around 1833. This was a study by a bunch of physician scientists, and what it was, there was a man who had gotten some gunshot wound, and apparently in his gut and had left a gaping hole there. And while the docs were about to fix him up there, they noticed something interesting, which was it was nice and red and rosy underneath with the blood flowing there. And they would get the guy angry about something and it would suddenly get pale. It would blanch. It would be a much lighter color. You would decrease the blood flow to the intestines there. I mean, this is just sheer speculation, but maybe the guy was getting angry because, like, the damn doctors were sitting there, like, doing a science project on him instead of sewing him up. But this was some of the first evidence that stress will divert blood flow from an unessential area like the gut. That same logic from the first lecture, digest food, grow, reproduce, do all that stuff later. If there is a later, it's not essential right now. Deliver the blood where it's needed. So that's great. You've increased your heart rate. You've increased your blood pressure, your breathing rate. You're delivering the energy where it's needed. That's terrific. One additional thing you need to do, though. So you're that zebra, you've just gotten ripped to shreds by a lion, and you're bleeding like mad, and what do you want to do at that point? This may be a good point to try to get some more blood into your system. Try to decrease the amount of blood flowing out and try to replace it. How do you decrease the blood flowing out? One of the things you do at that point is you make a certain type of red blood cell, a platelet, a certain type of blood cell, and thanks to epinephrine, during a crisis, the platelets get stickier, they get gummier, more viscous, and what do? They facilitate forming a clot to stop the outflow of blood. So that's a great adaptation to decrease the amount of blood going out. But you got another problem here, which is you've lost a lot of the blood already. You want some replacement blood. How are you going to do that? Well, one solution is to make yourself some more blood cells, more red blood cells and white blood. And that's great. That's a great solution, but it's going to take you days or weeks to build those up again. So how else can you replace missing blood? Get some more water into your circulation. Increase your blood volume with more fluid. That'll make it easier to increase the blood pressure. Get some more fluid in there. So where are you going to get the fluid from? You're obviously, like in this physical crisis there, you're not going to suddenly get a lot more thirsty and drink a tureen of something. But where can you get water from? Your kidneys. What are your kidneys usually doing? They're sitting there, they're filtering water in, out of your circulation, salt balance, all sorts of stuff. And what you need to do is send a message down to the kidney saying, reabsorb some of that water. Don't turn it into urine. And what you secrete is a hormone from your pituitary called ADH, antidiuretic hormone. A diuretic is something that makes you urinate. Tea, for example, is a diuretic. And an antidiuretic hormone is something that makes you anti-diuresis. It makes you stop urinating and it causes your kidneys to retain more of the water. So that's great. That's terrific. Your blood pressure has gone up. Your heart rate has gone up. You're delivering it where it's needed. You're clotting blood if you're bleeding badly. And you've got this great mechanism here by which you reabsorb water out of the kidneys back into your circulation to maintain blood volume. Now, this makes wonderful sense, except this brings up one of these questions, a question which is so rarely aired in our public schools, part of the tragedy that is public education these days, so little discussed during educational sort of venues. This is this mystery of an enigma wrapped within a mystery, which is why is it if you're so stressed, sometime you're going to pee in your pants? This doesn't make any sense. Because we've just seen the logic during the stress response is reabsorb water from the kidney, all of that. Why is it, though, that you have this paradoxical finding, nonetheless, that with the onset of severe stress, you lose control? And this is sufficiently the case that in many of the states where there are executions still, people are typically executed in diapers because you tend to wet your pants. Now, in order to appreciate the answer to this, we have to wrestle with the deep abiding question of why do we have bladders? Now, bladder is kind of weird. The kidney is great. The kidney's wonderful. So you said you put water in, you take water out, you futz around with sodium, and it's great. You could do it all day long. It's a great hobby. By the time stuff gets down to your kidneys and leaves your kidneys and then heads to your bladder is just this bladder thing. It doesn't do anything regulatory. It just stores stuff. By the time the urine goes south of your kidneys there, you can kiss it goodbye. You can't get it back from the bladder. It's just sitting there. Now, what's a bladder for in a lot of species? All sorts of species scent mark. What they do is individuals use their bladder, build up urine, and they go and they urinate around the periphery of their territory, and that gives all sorts of stay out of here, I mean it signals to anybody else smelling the urine. Scent marking is a very frequent use for urine in various species. That makes sense to have a bladder. However, we're not a scent-marking species. That's typically not what we do. Although there's some interesting exceptions. I was actually reading recently when General George Patton was leading the troops into Germany during World War II, finally getting into Germany. Apparently, there was the point when they got to the Rhine River that Patton walked out to the middle of the bridge, and in front of his adoring, triumphant, cheering troops, he very ritualistically peed into the Rhine and announced, "I've been waiting a long time to do that." Actually, this seems to be a frequent theme in the military. I'm not quite sure why, but apparently also during the Korean War, very often you had American troops lined up on one side of the Yalu River, Chinese on the other, and apparently at this, you know, interface, this point of stalemate, the American troops would regularly line up and urinate into the Yalu River. Take that, as they sent mark there. So despite these deeply moving historical circumstances of people urinating like hamsters. Nonetheless, we still have this mystery, what's a bladder for? It's not clear. And the most important thing about it is it doesn't seem to be doing much. And here you have your classic acute physical crisis. You are running for your life. The lion's coming after you. And suddenly you got your choice. You could run for your life with or without 5 pounds of fluid sloshing around there on the bottom. You void your bladder. You get rid of the excess urine. So now we see exactly how the system works here. What's going on? Acute stressor, increased blood pressure, increased heart rate, retain the fluids there, clot, send it where it's needed, nowhere else, makes wonderful sense for the short-term stress response. And now we barrel into our, by now, obligatory second half of this dichotomy. What happens when you do all of this too long because of chronic stress, especially chronic psychological stress? What you do is increase your blood pressure for 30 seconds, run away from the lion, you're saving your life. Increase your blood pressure chronically and you are suffering from chronic hypertension, chronically elevated blood pressure. Little bit of the nuts and bolts first. How does that happen? So you have periods of the heart working really hard, pumping with more force, pumping more frequently. Blood pressure is increasing. It's going through the blood vessels with more force, distending the blood vessels out more from the sheer force of it. The blood vessels, in response, slowly begin to build up more muscle wrapping around them in response to this distension. They build up more muscle, which makes the blood vessels more rigid, which requires more force to get the blood through there. So you increase the blood pressure ever more, and we've got a vicious cycle here. So that's how you begin to get problems with hypertension. So what's the price that you pay? First off, at the level of your heart, what happens with heart function when you are chronically hypertensive? You know, you get cardiologists and they're pretty impressed with the heart and would try to convince you of the same. Ultimately, a heart is just some big old mechanical pump like you could buy at Sears, and it has a lot of the same principles. If you make it work very hard, it begins to wear out after a while. And one version of the wearing out is if blood pressure is greatly increased, your heart muscle walls will pay for it. The heart pumps out the blood from one of its chambers, and the blood circulates around and comes back into a different chamber of the heart. And by definition, if it's being pumped out with a lot more force, it's going to slam back in there with more force and pound away on the wall there. And it happens to be it's the left ventricle. That's the area that takes the brunt of returning blood under high force. And the muscle there begins to enlarge. You got a hypertrophied left ventricle. And what is that sort of wobbly sort of extra muscle on that side? It begins to set the heart up for irregularities. So that's a problem. That's a first step there where you can get into trouble thanks to chronic hypertension. What about at the level of your blood vessels themselves? What could be happening there that gets you into trouble? And where you get your biggest problems has to do with a principle that runs through a lot of physiological systems in your circulatory system, your pulmonary system, a process called bifurcation. Okay, coming out of your heart, descending, for example, is one big, huge blood vessel called the descending aorta. Don't worry about the name of it. One big, huge blood vessel, which after a certain distance splits into two. Bifurcates into two. And after a while, those two smaller vessels, each one of those is going to split into two, bifurcate, bifurcate, bifurcate endlessly until you've bifurcated your way down into little capillaries. What the circulatory system is about is a whole bunch of these bifurcations. So what's one of the things that happens when you increase blood pressure? The bifurcation, the point right where it divides, that's the point of the wall of the blood vessel that is splitting this river of blood and splitting it in two. Or another way of stating it is, that's the part of your blood vessel that's getting pounded with the most force there. So you increase blood pressure and you begin to have a problem that's straight out of ninth grade physics, and it describes all sorts of fluids moving through any sort of tube. This is why your bathroom plumbing wears out after a while. By definition, if you've got a tube and you got fluid moving through it and it moves through with more force, you've increased your blood pressure, move it through with more force and you eventually begin to get fluid turbulence and little eddies and little tsunamis of blood there. And as you begin to get the turbulence, what it does is it slams into the walls of the blood vessels with more force. And again, particularly taking the brunt of it are those points of bifurcation. So enough of that slamming against the walls of the blood vessels, and you begin to get little bits of damage there, little bits of tearing, little bits of scarring, little bit of spots there that wind up getting inflamed. And that turns out to be a critical process there, one that's appreciated more and more in cardiology. You begin to get little bits of inflammation around these spots of vessel damage. Inflammation, there's all sorts of inflammatory cells that wind up getting in there, start sticking to there, and suddenly it's beginning to glom things up there a bit. You're beginning to get a bit of a plaque. Why does that get you in trouble? For lots of reasons now. Now along comes fat and glucose and cholesterol, and that stuff is more likely to stick onto this inflamed little plaque. Where's the fat and glucose and cholesterol coming from? That's exactly the stuff you're mobilizing at a storage site to feed your exercising muscle. So you get this double whammy here between the metabolic stress response and the cardiovascular one. Now, this whole business about inflammation has really come to the forefront in the field. 20 years ago, if you could only measure one thing in the bloodstream and you wanted to get a sense about how somebody's cardiovascular system was doing, what would you measure? You would measure somebody's cholesterol levels. That was the number everybody got obsessed over. That was the number you would use as a pickup line at parties, bragging about how low your cholesterol. That was just the defining point of the field. And in recent years, people have realized more and more, your amount of cholesterol is important, but something else is more important. In other words, you can have just cholesterol coming out the wazoo. You could be eating 3 dozen eggs a day, and if you had absolutely unblemished, healthy blood vessel walls, the cholesterol really doesn't have much to stick to. It's not until you begin to get inflammation, inflammatory damage there, that the cholesterol has a spot that it's going to home in on. The inflammation appears to be the starting step. And it's for that reason that there's been this transition in the field from we can only measure one thing, measuring cholesterol, over to measuring one thing, something called CRP, C-reactive protein, which is a marker of the amount of inflammation. So that's a problem. But you can set yourself up for a second problem here. And this is one that's been shown in a lot of experimental settings. Okay, you have hypertension, and that could set you up for damage to your blood vessels. Very interesting research, very clear-cut research done with non-human primates showing that if you couple hypertension with a high-fat diet, you get far more vascular damage than either alone. And this turns out to make perfect sense. One reason is obvious. You get more fat, and we've just heard if you've got inflamed, damaged blood vessels, more fat there is going to be more likely to glom on and cause an atherosclerotic plaque and plug up your blood vessels. As we're going to hear in a subsequent lecture, people are just realizing there's a really interesting, unexpected additional reason, which is you have a high-fat diet, and you're going to get more fat stored in your body. And something that just knocked fatologists on their rear as this became clear is fat cells are able to secrete certain inflammatory messengers. Totally interesting, unexpected. What's our implication here? A high-fat diet is always also going to increase the amount of these inflammatory signals coming out of your fat cells. So look now, when you have a high-fat diet, whatever damage there is to the blood vessels, they're more likely to get inflammatory plaques forming, and the elevated fat, glucose, cholesterol is more likely to stick onto, you're going to get more atherosclerotic disease. And what that sets you up for are a number of different types of potential disasters. You block the blood vessel here entirely, or it's partially blocked and you get enough blood force, enough shearing force, that eventually you knock this little plaque loose. You get what's called a thrombus, and that could get you into real trouble now. If it goes wandering up into one of your heart vessels, coronary heart vessels, and clogs things there, you might have a heart attack. If it gets into a vessel in the brain, you have a stroke. Not good. Now, what this brings us to is this third outpost of what can go wrong. We've now seen how chronic hypertension, how chronic stress-induced hypertension can be bad news for your heart muscles, can be bad news for your blood vessels. Now to focus in on a particular type of blood vessel, one I just alluded to, the blood vessels bringing blood to your heart, your coronary blood vessels. Now, when you think about it at first, this actually doesn't make any sense at all. Wait a second, your heart, which is just swimming around in oceans of blood, your heart has to have specialized blood vessels feeding it blood. When it's the heart, what it does is it's in contact with blood. This initially makes no sense, but think about, you know, you work in the building that regulates water flow through some reservoir, town reservoir, and you work 15 feet away from the reservoir, and you're thirsty. If you're thirsty, you don't go out to the reservoir with a bucket and drop it down in there and pull some water out of there to sip the rest of the day. What do? You do what you do anywhere else in the city. You go to a water fountain that's in there in the building. It is exactly equivalent to what happens in the heart. Heart muscle can't feed itself from these oceans of blood blasting in and out. So you have coronary blood vessels. And it turns out, coronary blood vessels are not vessels you want to damage from chronic hypertension. Normally, there's something really helpful that coronary blood vessels do when they're perfectly healthy. Along comes the lion, you're running for your life, it's a crisis, you need more blood delivered to your heart because your heart's working so hard, and in a healthy coronary blood vessel, something terrific happens there. They vasodilate, they increase, they become looser, so even more blood can go blasting through there and bring energy, and your heart could keep up with demands. That's great. Begin to damage those coronary blood vessels, that inflammatory plaque stuff, and something so insidious, so unfair happens at that point in terms of how things can go so wrong. What begins to happen is, once those coronary vessels are damaged, when you increase blood flow during a period of stress, these vessels no longer vasodilate, they constrict. They constrict, and exactly when your heart needs a ton of blood, there's less of it coming through. And this is not a good thing. How does this work? It turns out there's some chemicals that are released from the coronary blood vessels when the heart's working hard that vasodilate a bunch of these. Interestingly, one of those chemicals is related to nitric oxide. So they normally work there, but begin to get damaged coronary blood vessels with plaques and stuff. And this nice, helpful vasodilatory signals are unable to get out there. So you're totally up the creek now. You've got damaged coronary blood vessels, and exactly when your heart needs more energy during a major stressor, that's exactly when these blood vessels stab you in the heart by constricting even more. And your heart, thus, does not get enough blood flow. It doesn't get enough oxygen, it doesn't get enough glucose, it doesn't get enough energy, and you have cardiac ischemia, myocardial ischemia. Your heart muscles are not getting enough of the stuff they need. Now, studying that was traditionally kind of hard to do because the only way you could see if somebody had this problem with cardiac ischemia would be to put them in this very artificial setting, take them into the doctor's office and make them run to the point of exhaustion on a treadmill while you've got all the electrodes stuck up with them. And you could get information, but this admittedly is a very artificial setting. Not a lot of people who are potentially having emerging heart disease are having problems with it because they are running up dozens of flights of stairs nonstop and then seeing what their blood pressure was like. Instead, the problems pop up throughout the day. So the question became, what's happening to function of coronary vessels throughout the day? When you begin to have vessels that are damaged, who knows? You can't measure it. And then some years back, somebody came up with the wonderful technology where you can measure it. You could do what's called ambulatory cardiology, where you got these little devices there monitor, and it could monitor what's going on with your heart throughout the day. And back came a surprise, which is people who begin to have damaged coronary blood vessels, they're having those little ischemic insults to their heart muscles just all the time throughout the day. This is not the realm of massive sudden physical stressor and that history of stress-induced damage to your blood vessels. You begin to pay for it then. It was shocking to everyone how often you get little problems with that, and how often then the heart muscle is not getting enough energy and it hurts. Angina is the term for it. So we've seen here ways in which you can get into trouble by too much sympathetic arousal with chronic stress, damaging your heart muscles, damaging vessels throughout your body, damaging the coronary blood vessels. All of that conceptually due to too much of a let's kick into action signal coming. Too much sympathetic nervous system. There's a flip side to it as well, which is you can also get into trouble if you have too little of the inhibitory signal coming in there. Too little of parasympathetic tone. You remember sympathetic, emergency arousal, parasympathetic, calm, vegetative, activate the parasympathetic nervous system and your heart's going to slow down by way of something called the vagus nerve. So you can get into trouble either by too much sympathetic screaming at your heart or too little vagal calming, or if you're really in for trouble, both of them are going wrong, and this is another way you can have problems there. Interesting way you could pick up on that, showing just how delicate this whole system is. Inhale, take a breath in, and you slightly stimulate your sympathetic nervous system, and your heart rate increases a little bit. Exhale, and you stimulate parasympathetic, and things slow down a little bit. So if the system is working wonderfully, every time you inhale, you get a little sympathetic hiccup, exhale, parasympathetic, and you look at the pattern of beats, they're a little bit longer, a little shorter, a little bit longer, they're quite variable. Begin to have a damaged parasympathetic nervous system. If stress has been driving it to the point where it really doesn't do what it's supposed to do, you inhale, and your heart rate speeds up a little bit. You exhale, and because the parasympathetic nervous system has been driven into a coma, you don't get as much of a slowing down. What does that look like? You look at somebody's heart rate pattern, and there's not as much of that variability. That's a very hot subject these days for picking up problems with parasympathetic nervous system. Okay, so all of these are scenarios where chronic stress will chronically pound away at your blood vessels, your heart, all of that. And all of that can potentially culminate into one of the great crises, which is sudden cardiac death. And we all know the dramatic version of it. Guy gets terrible news and he's wailing and suddenly he clutches his chest and keels over dead and sudden cardiac arrest. And for the most part, this is a movie plot. This is very rare. Nonetheless, it pops up in all sorts of settings. One example, during the 1991 Gulf War, there were attacks from Iraq, Scud missiles onto Israel, and the number of people killed by missiles were considerably smaller than the number of people who had heart attacks during the period of the missile strikes. Sudden cardiac arrest. Massive increase in cardiac demand. You're running away from a lion. You're running a marathon. You are just euphoric and hyperactive and agitated because you've just taken some guy's pawn in this chess game. Whatever it is, you can push things to a point where down you go. It is too extreme. And this brings up a final really interesting point, which is, what about when you get people who have heart attacks, even sudden cardiac death, not because a lion is chasing them, but because they're in the middle of something wildly pleasurable? The archetypal example, of course, being the person who has a fatal heart attack right in the middle of sex. What is that about? We're talking about stress here. What's this going on? And what this brings in here is the possibility of something such as fatal pleasure. And it makes perfect sense. If you are leaping up with joy or leaping up with terror or leaping up with rage, you're leaping up. It's taking muscular work. Your heart's having to work harder. And when you look closely at what the heart's up to, when it is an activated state, you cannot tell whether this is someone who is just about to commit murder or someone who is just about to have an orgasm. And this brings up a point that will come back again and again. And it's one that's very well summarized by Elie Wiesel, concentration camp survivor, Nobel laureate, a phrase that he's often used, which is, the opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of love is indifference. In his context, what it's about is the opposite of love is not hate. The way you express the opposite of love is to perhaps be indifferent to somebody's suffering, to be indifferent to a people's suffering, to be indifferent enough not to have a rule of never again will this happen to anyone. The opposite of love is not hate. Physiologically, what we've just seen is, quite similarly, the opposite of love is not hate. Extreme love, extreme hate, What your sympathetic nervous system can be doing is quite similar. What all parts of your body are doing can be quite similar. This is a theme that will come back again and again. So what do we have at this point? We have our first organ system under our belts here, and we have our first clear evidence that this dichotomy really works. Short-term cardiovascular stress response, wonderful adaptive news. Chronic, it gets you into trouble in all sorts of ways, and this is the format, this is the general structure for all the lectures to come for a while as we move from one organ system to the next.
Lecture 4, Stress, Metabolism, and Liquidating Your Assets.
We are back, ready for our next organ system to fall apart in the face of chronic stress. And what we will focus on in this lecture is metabolism. Metabolism, the movement of energy into storage sites, out of storage sites, from your digestive tract into the circulation. And you already know what the punchline for this entire lecture is, which is when you have excess food, you store it away. And when you are running for your life, you get the stuff out of storage, and it's all just minor details from here. Okay, so metabolism. Where do you start off with? The process of how food goes from your gut after you've eaten it to beginning to be useful to your body. Broadly, there's three constituents that you can get into food. It's protein, it's carbs, and it's fat. Protein is made up of amino acids, and as per usual, do not panic. If this is a level of detail that's more than you want, get the broad themes. Protein is made up of amino acids. You eat protein, your stomach and intestines do their thing, and what you dump into the bloodstream are amino acids, the broken down building blocks of protein. Same thing, carbohydrates are complex collections of sugars like glucose. From your gut to your bloodstream, the process of breaking down complex carbohydrates down to simple sugars. Finally, same theme, fat. Fat going from your gut, broken down to its constituent parts, fatty acids, glycerol. So now you've got your basic fuel, your energetic fuel in your bloodstream, in the form of amino acids, in the form of free fatty acids, in the form of simple sugars, and we've got our first situation, which is you've got excess of that stuff in your bloodstream. You are well fed, you've got, if anything, surplus amounts. What do? You store it away. You store it away. And what you do is you store it back in the complex form that it started off in. And what we have here is our economic metaphor. You've got excess money. Most of us don't put all our extra coins, making up our gazillions of dollars. We don't stuff them in our mattresses anymore. We take advantage of the large, complex world of economics, which I understand nothing about. You store it away as stocks and bonds and soybean futures and who knows what else. You store the stuff away in a complex storage form. What do? Exactly the opposite of the digestion that you already have gone through. You take the circulating amino acids, you stick them together as proteins, and you store them in various parts of your body. You take those simple sugars that are circulating around, you stick a bunch of them together, and you store them in the form of glycogen. Take those individual constituents of fat, free fatty acids, glycerol, you put them back together, and you store those away. Very simple. So we've got this economic metaphor going for us, and when you have excess resources available, what you do is you store them away. So along comes the mechanisms to explain that. How do you do that? How does your body sense that you have an excess of nutrients in your bloodstream? How does it store it away? The pivotal hormone that's involved in all of this is insulin. Insulin, which you secrete in response to elevated nutrient levels in your bloodstream. Remarkably enough, insulin, which you even secrete in anticipation of a meal, if you eat dinner at 6 o'clock every night, quarter of six, you are secreting insulin in preparation for storing away all those nutrients for long term. What part of your nervous system does that? Parasympathetic nervous system, sending projections down to your pancreas, which is where insulin comes from, all built around we are about to get an influx of nutrients and send out that signal to store it away. So insulin is this hormone of plenty. Insulin is this hormone of gluttonous excess. Probably the gross national insulin levels in our country peak the dinner after the evening after Thanksgiving dinner. And we have a hormone of planning for the future. So, as per usual, along comes an acute stressor. An acute stressor where you're running for your life from the lion, our usual scenario. And what do you need to do? You need energy not stored away, but powering whichever muscles are going to save your life. What do? You reverse everything that we've done just now. You break down the storage forms of energy and you flush them into the circulation. You turn it back into cash. Hormones responsible. As promised, we are coming back to some of the ones that were mentioned briefly in lecture two, glucocorticoids, epinephrine by way of the sympathetic nervous system, glucagon, an otherwise obscure hormone. What are all of these about? Glucocorticoids, glucagon, they go and they take that stored glycogen and turn it into glucose. In your circulation, they mobilize the storage form of carbohydrates into circulating sugars. They're doing the same thing with your proteins in storage sites. Have those proteins broken down to their constituent amino acids, dump them in the bloodstream, break down the storage forms of fat, all with this logical message, you are running for your life and you need the energy in the circulation, not store it away for some building project long in the future. You do something else in addition. You stop the secretion of insulin. Very logical, which is the last thing you want to be doing is sending some signal to your body saying store away energy at the same time that you're trying to mobilize it. Not a good thing. So you secrete glucocorticoids, glucagon, epinephrine, you mobilize stored energy forms, and you shut down insulin secretion so that you're not storing anything. So we've got the basics here. What happens next? What's going to happen next is perfectly obvious. Our transition here from running for your life to what do you do in the face of chronic stress? And what you've got here is lots of potential for problems. First one, we go back to our financial metaphor, and once again on thin ice for me, but apparently, there's this problem. You've got such a gross excess of money that you stick it away in the bank in some long-term savings account. And what you do is you agree to some deal there, which is I will put this away and not touch it for X amount of time. And in exchange, I'll get this vast amount of interest when it comes out the other end. And one of the things that you also get is the possibility of a penalty for early withdrawal. In other words, you store away the energy there, you store away your resources, and you suddenly get into this neurotic, psychologically stressed state where you want to reverse the whole process and you pay a penalty. So we've got this metaphor. You store stuff away in the bank and suddenly you get anxious and you go and you pay the penalty and you withdraw it. And an hour later, you decide you're not anxious after all. You deposit it again. And the next day you withdraw, you pay another penalty. The exact same thing with metabolism. You store energy for the future because you've got excess, get into a stressed state, mobilize it, store it away, mobilize it again. This cycle of chronic stress, this cycle of chronically activating, mobilizing energy storage, and then sticking it back again afterward. What's the equivalent of a penalty? None of our biochemistry of storage and mobilization, none of that is 100% efficient. You pay a little bit of a penalty in terms of all of the biochemistry. It costs a little bit to generate those storage forms. It costs a little bit to break them down again. Back and forth you go. So that's the first problem you get into. A second potential problem is one with a rather specialized disease, one which unfortunately is becoming more prevalent, but it's one where glucose, sugar in the bloodstream, is at the very heart of what goes wrong. Juvenile diabetes. Two different types of diabetes. One version, most broadly, is you're not secreting enough insulin. The other problem is where, if anything, you've got too much insulin. We will see shortly that's a gross simplification, blah, blah, all the usual, but starting first with juvenile diabetes. In that, there's something wrong with your pancreas, there's something wrong with the cells in your pancreas that secrete insulin. Some evidence that there's a genetic component of vulnerability, your immune system attacks your pancreas, whatever it is, those cells are damaged and you're not secreting enough insulin right now. So back to what we saw before, which was the storage issue. You've got excess nutrients in your bloodstream and you want to store them away, and you do that with insulin, as we heard, except thanks to your juvenile diabetes, you are not able to store it for lack of insulin, so you get, too much sugar in your bloodstream, and the places in your body that need the sugar don't get them. You take yourself synthetic insulin, and if you take too much of it, it clears away too much glucose. What you do virtually nonstop as a juvenile diabetic is you try to keep your blood glucose levels within a normal range. And there's been a wonderful amount of technological advances in terms of getting feedback. Juvenile diabetics finding out what their blood glucose level is with a high frequency, manipulating their intake as a result. This is what juvenile diabetes management is all about, keeping blood glucose levels in a nice steady range. Now you got juvenile diabetes and you are chronically stressed. Chronically, you get stressed, you get over it, you get stressed again. What are you doing each time? You're releasing a flood of sugar into your bloodstream and then you're storing it away. What are you doing? The very opposite of what blood sugar control is about in diabetes. You're getting these huge oscillations all over the place. In other words, what chronic stress does is make glycemic control, control of sugar, more precarious in a diabetic. And this is where you see a very frequent problem with juvenile diabetics, which is, by definition, very often juvenile diabetics are juveniles. And occasionally they act juvenile, which is to say they don't do all the nice prudent things you're supposed to do with your diabetes. And instead, they don't eat the right food and they don't eat it at the right frequency and they don't get enough sleep. And what you've got is wreaking havoc again with your blood glucose levels. All that stress does there is push you even more in that direction. So what about the next realm of trouble with chronic stress? What about another type of diabetes? Okay, so we've gotten this main pattern here so far, which is you want to mobilize stored energy processes into your bloodstream in the face of stress. And mind you, there's a very subtle version of mobilizing energy out of storage sites in the face of stress. What's the most stressful thing that happens to us each day in the course of perfectly calm functioning? Getting up in the morning, having to start functioning, moving those muscles that have been quiescent for hours. What you see is the hormones of the metabolic stress response, just within their normal non-stressed range, happen to peak around the time you wake up. Because that's starting the day with this increased energy demand. You're some nocturnal species. You don't wake up until, the evening, and then you go about your business. Those hormones peak their levels in the evening. Right around the time you wake up, up go glucocorticoid levels, epinephrine, glucagon, dealing with the incredible stress of waking up every morning. But real stress, real big-time stress, and real big-time stress chronically, we're now looking at another way you get into trouble. First version, as we saw, this inefficient use of energy. Store it, mobilize, and you pay this penalty of early withdrawal of inefficient storage and mobilization. You pay the price there. Second version that we just saw, which is the chronic metabolic stress response wreaks havoc with juvenile diabetic glycemic control. Now we're into the other type of diabetes. And this is the type of diabetes that is coming to haunt Western societies big time. This is what's known as adult onset diabetes, also known as insulin-resistant diabetes, all sorts of other terms for it. What this is exactly the problem of juvenile diabetes. Exactly the opposite problem, ultimately, though. Exactly the same problem, blood sugar levels. Exactly the opposite problem. The problem here isn't too little insulin. You got no problem with insulin. The problem here is an excess of nutrients. What are you doing, typically? You are getting older in a westernized way, which is to say, you put on weight, you become more sedentary, and you've got all these excess nutrients in your bloodstream from all that cholesterol and carbohydrates and proteins you've been consuming. What's the logical thing you would be doing at this point? Excess, let's store it away. Let's secrete a ton of insulin and let's store it away. But your problem is, you've stored so much away already that your fat cells are full. Your fat cells are full, and you've got a big problem at this point, which is they can't get any fuller. Back to the metabolic stress response. What do? As we heard, you secrete glucagon and glucocorticoids and epinephrine to mobilize energy. You block insulin release. There's one interesting additional piece in there, and it's essentially built around the notion that your brain doesn't trust your pancreas. Your brain believes your pancreas can screw up readily. Here comes a stressor where you need to mobilize energy. What would be the stupidest thing to do at that time? Secrete insulin at the same time. We've already seen the pancreas stops insulin secretion. But the brain doesn't trust it. The brain is convinced those idiots down in the pancreas are still going to be drooling out a little bit of insulin. One additional step occurs, which is your brain indirectly sends a signal to fat cells, storage sites throughout your body, and what it says is, don't listen to any insulin. Don't respond to an insulin signal in case they're still secreting insulin down in that pancreas. Become resistant to it. Lose your sensitivity to it. What happens during the stress response is your body very logically, under the acute circumstances, pushes you towards insulin resistance. How does this work? An enormous amount of research has gone into it. Basic kind of biochemistry stuff, do not panic again, but insulin binds to an insulin receptor, just like every hormone binds to its own personal receptor. And what you've got with insulin induced resistance in these cases here, which is something gets uncoupled so that insulin binds to its receptor, but its receptor, which then was supposed to send a signal saying store the nutrients, doesn't listen to it. The receptor becomes ineffective. This is a mechanism people are spending their whole careers working out the nuts and bolts of it. The main point is, run for your life. And you are getting a signal throughout the body not only to not secrete insulin, but don't respond to insulin. Do it chronically, and your body is giving off signals all over the place saying, don't listen to insulin. You become insulin resistant. So here's this scenario again. You are eating to great excess, and your fat cells are full, and essentially what they're saying there is, forget it. We're full. We've got no more space. We're fully occupied. There's no more beds. Hit the road. Go to someplace else. The inn is full. We're not responding to insulin anymore. That's the mechanism by which too much stored energy, being overweight, begins to make fat cells less responsive to insulin. And along comes chronic stress superimposed on top of that. And what's the stress response system saying? It's saying, what a great idea. That is a brilliant idea to don't respond to the insulin. So you've got this double whammy. You're having insulin resistance because your fat cells are completely full and they're just not responding anymore because they're completely full. And in addition, just in case they're still a little bit responsive to insulin, if you were chronically turning on the stress response, you were saying, yeah, become even more insulin resistant. And what you're now skating into the neighborhood of is insulin resistant diabetes. So what's the problem there? Is the problem that you don't have enough energy in throughout your body? Absolutely not. That's the problem in juvenile diabetes. You're not sending an insulin signal saying store energy, take up energy. That's not the problem. You got plenty of insulin. The problem is amid too much energy stored away, you've got all this excess stuff now in your bloodstream because there's stuff there that's not getting stored because the storage cells are not responding to insulin. So now you got fat and glucose and cholesterol just circling around in your bloodstream with nothing to do, just looking for problems like glomming onto those damaged blood vessels. As we saw in the last lecture, you get hyperglycemia, you get elevated blood sugars along with the fats and such, and they just get into trouble if they've got no place to go. And they've got no place to go because your fat cells are full and because you're chronically stressed and your body is saying, don't even listen to any insulin out there. So the characteristics of adult onset diabetes is not that you are lacking energy in cells throughout the body. They've got more than they can use, elevated insulin, elevated glucose levels in the bloodstream, often elevated fat levels, triglycerides in your blood, and stuff like that just circulating 24/7 is not a good thing. It gets into trouble, often in terms of the cardiovascular damage we heard in the last lecture. So that is a problem. That is a huge problem. Because adult onset diabetes, insulin resistant diabetes, used to be this incredibly obscure outpost of disease. This was a problem that our great, 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 great grandparents never thought about. As said, it is a disease becoming more prevalent with westernized lifestyle, putting on weight, becoming sedentary. This once obscure disease is now right on the edge of being our number one killer, its consequences. This once obscure disease is slated to become the planet's biggest killer within a couple of decades or so, according to the estimates of the World Health Organization. This once obscure disease of adult onset insulin resistance is now occurring at a higher frequency among kids than even juvenile diabetes is. This is part of where we are getting in major metabolic trouble, and all that chronic stress does is tell your body, what a great idea, do even more of it. So here's this whole problem here with the potential for chronic stress to worsen your symptoms of adult onset diabetes. So we've had our theme here. Once again, you have excess energy and everything is perfectly fine. You store it away. You have an emergency. You acutely take the storage stuff, dump it in your bloodstream, and it powers your muscles. That's wonderful. You do it chronically and you mess up blood sugar levels. You make it harder for a juvenile diabetic to control their blood glucose levels. Stress plays havoc with diabetic control. And you increase your risk, as we've seen, of adult onset diabetes. So you've already heard one thing here, one interesting thing, which harks back to the previous lecture, that business, you've got all this glucose in your bloodstream because you have adult onset diabetes and you're not storing the stuff. And the circulating glucose, the fat going along with it, is likely to glom onto those bits of blood vessel damage with the inflammatory cells. Suddenly, we have leapt from the world of metabolic disease, diabetes and such, and suddenly we're back half an hour into cardiovascular disease. And this has been a very interesting shift in the field over the last decade or so. It used to be you have screwy blood glucose levels and you go to a physician who deals with metabolism. Meanwhile, if somebody else has a problem with high blood pressure, they go to someone who specializes in the cardiovascular nervous system. And if everything goes right, those two types of doctor specialists never talk to each other. They go to completely different conventions. They have different languages. Their children can't marry. These are two totally different realms of disease. And what should be apparent by now is they intertwine. And what you've got is the kind of circumstances that plays havoc with your metabolic profile with chronic stress increases your risk of cardiovascular disease. And the problems you get with cardiovascular excessive mobilization with chronic stress increases your risk of metabolic disease. Suddenly they are completely intertwined. And this intertwining is the rationale behind this large overall sort of catchment term for what can go wrong in this realm, metabolic syndrome. Metabolic syndrome, in its original version, known as Syndrome X, I believe, until people got more of a sense of it and it got a real name, metabolic syndrome is the syndrome, the array of symptoms that increase your risk of metabolic disease and or cardiovascular disease. The two of them suddenly intertwine. And this is a realm in which you get a whole hodgepodge of things wrong. You've got increased blood pressure. You've got vascular resistance due to damage in your blood vessels. You've got elevated glucose levels. You've got your fat cells not responding to insulin. It's a whole connection of these things going wrong. Yes, you can have a bunch of metabolic things going wrong, and at the same time, you can have